Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide daily over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, business, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So, stay tuned for tonight's special report on the tyranny of experts when we come back. You know, over the past century, we Americans who were once independent, capable, and able to manage our own financial, medical, and legal affairs have now been reduced to dependents, incompetence, incapacity. And we've been made wards of these powerful commercial, financial, medical, and legal corporations, cartels, and bureaucratic institutions of our modern industrial society. And we've been taught to rely upon these paid professionals like bankers to manage our financial affairs, and doctors to manage and treat our health problems, and lawyers to direct our business and legal affairs instead of relying upon our own good common sense. That's why I contend that it's time that we Americans who were once able to catch our own fish learn, once again, how to fish instead of being fed by all of these paid professionals. Regaining our power of attorney is the single most important step in regaining our capacity, our rights, our liberties, and our duties. Now, if you'd like to learn more about this thing called courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you write for our free general law CD package? Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. That's georgegordon.org, and download it off the archives page. Hey, paid professionals are everywhere. They're like pig tracks in a barnyard. Here in the United States, we rely upon our paid professionals, and we rely upon them to such a degree that we can't live our lives without them. You know, paid professionals are people like economists and bankers and lawyers and doctors and real estate brokers and stock brokers, these professionals. And we rely upon them to such a degree that we subscribe to their publications, and we hang upon their every word. Politicians rely upon these paid professionals, and they bring them into the Congress to have them testify. And they come into the committees, and they testify before the committees, economists do, and they say, well, here's what we've got to do to solve the financial crisis. And then Congress enacts the laws. It doesn't solve the financial crisis, but we believe it will, so that's why we follow the advice of the paid professionals. I mean, What do you and I know, the Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives? What in the hell do we know about economics? And so, you know, some guy comes along, he says, well, look at my credentials. You know, I'm a cum laude saint something or other from the University of so-and-so, and I've got all these pieces of paper on my wall that tell everybody how smart I am. And then I won a Nobel Prize for economics, and so that's why I come into the Congress and testify and tell these people how to run their economic affairs and how to run the economic affairs of the nation. Now, we're in debt, I don't know, $13, $14, $15 trillion. It doesn't sound like to me that people that are in debt are very good at figuring out business. What I would like to see is somebody that has no debt whatsoever, free and clear, has $1 million in the bank, come into the Congress and testify, well, here's the way I would run the thing if I was running it. It just seems like to me that an academic from Harvard who hasn't got a pot to piss in, a place to put it, or a window to throw it out of, is not the guy you should go to ask about making money. It would seem like to me that the guy that we should go to ask about making money is some guy that's already made a bunch. And then I ask him, well, what did you do to make a bunch of money? And then if we would get that guy to come into Congress and testify, and then if the Congress would follow that guy's formula, we might do better, it would just seem like to me. Let's take a look at health. These same committees in Congress call in experts from the FDA. They have doctors come in, medical doctors, psychiatrists, psychologists, and they testify, and they say, well, what we need is more vaccination. If we just had more vaccination and we had more government money spent on vaccinating everybody, we'd all have better health. Now, back at the turn of the century, before we had vaccination and before we had, you know, health professionals testifying before Congress, we had cancer. There was no problem with the cancer. It was there. It was there. It's been there for thousands of years, probably created right there in the Garden of Eden when God got through with the creation. I'm sure that he had some cancer in the mix, maybe a little autism, maybe he had a little, he might have had a little Alzheimer's and ADHD and crib death, mixed into the creation. I don't know, but it looks like to me that in 1900, when one person in 33 would get cancer in his lifetime, while it was there, it wasn't much of a problem. Today, it's one person out of every two, 50%. That's you and me sitting here in the room. One of us is going to get cancer in our lifetime. That's more than one in 33. Now, we've been listening to these experts telling us about cancer and vaccination and good health and hospitals and what we need to do, to live to be 140. If you take these vitamins and minerals and so on, you're gonna get this good health. This is the advice that we're getting. And then not only do we get this advice from these people that doesn't work, we've got more advice coming from other people that take the exact opposite position and say, no, don't do that. If you do that, you're going to get bad results. So what do Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives, people like us, the bottom feeders, as I refer to them. Now, I'm a bottom feeder. I'm just a Joe Sixpack out here, and I run a few cows, and I milk a few of them, and I eat a few. I have a few sheep, got some raised beds. I'm what's known as a producer, a farmer. And I actually produce real wealth. Comes out of the ground. Every year I produce some real wealth, about 10, 15 cows a year I market. And I probably sell 1,000 or produce, and I'm not selling all of it, but, I produce about 1,000, maybe 2,000 gallons of milk. Now, the paid professionals consume just like you and I do. All of us are consumers, but not all of us are producers. And professionals produce nothing and consume much. Take our president, for example. Nice guy that he is. The president of the United States. Prestigious fellow, produces nothing. He doesn't produce any meat, milk, butter, or eggs. He doesn't build houses. He doesn't fix pipes. He doesn't clear drains. He doesn't drive truck. He doesn't deliver anything anywhere. He pontificates. He comes on television and he tells us what's good for us. He says that, for instance, a national health care insurance would be good for us. He's not going to pay for it. You and I are going to pay for it. He says that the health insurance that we have is no good, and he's got a better plan. That's his job in life. That's what he does. He gives us better plans than the plans that we have. He says we got too much cancer, and we need to solve that problem. And healthcare costs too much, and we need to reduce the cost. Well, I don't want cancer, and I don't want a lot of healthcare expense. And neither do you. And so the president comes along and says, well, look at all this health care expense that you've got and all this cancer that you've got. Now, listen to me. Follow my advice. I'm a paid professional. And everything's going to be good. Everything's going to come out fine for you. Now, these politicians, the economists, the bankers, the lawyers, the brokers, doctors, and all these paid professionals out here have been doing this for thousands of years. They produce nothing. They consume much, and their advice isn't worth the powder it would take to blow them all to hell. And you know it, and I know it. And the other day, a fellow sent me an article. And there's a guy here who wrote this article, and he calls it The Tyranny of Experts. And his name is Morris E. Chaffetz, C-H-A-F-E-T-Z. He's a medical doctor. He's one of the problems. He's not necessarily the solution, but he admitted that he is a part of the tyranny of experts. Now, this article is excerpted, and it's adapted with the author's permission from The Tyranny of Experts, Blowing the Whistle on the Cult of Expertise, published by Madison Books in New York, 1996. It was 1995 then, and it's got an ISBN number. It's available through National Book Network. I'll give you the name and address of it two or three times here. It's probably worth reading. That's why I'm going to do a report on it. Because The Tyranny of Experts exposes the experts for what they are. Charlatans, frauds, people that don't know whether their ass is bored or punched, and couldn't find their hind ends at high noon with both hands and a roadmap. And I've said that for many, many years, and I thought, well, maybe I'm the only guy in the country that's got an eye to see and an ear to hear, but no. Lo and behold, here comes a medical doctor, he's also a psychiatrist, writes an article for the Psych News, what do you call this thing here now? It's called the Psych News International, Volume 3, Issue 2, July 1998. It's not a new article. It's been around for a long time, but you never read it, and you never heard about it, and neither did I. One of my listeners, a fellow who lives over in Okinawa, Japan, sent this to me. And he said, I thought you might get a kick out of this. Boy, did I get a kick out of it. It corroborates what I've been telling you, you know, for the last, I don't know, 25 or 30 years. Because I've just been observing. I'm sitting over here and I'm watching people. Let me give you a quick illustration here. When I was a kid, not very many people invested in stocks. Stocks were something that people invested in, but you had to be a professional. You were a stockbroker, you were an investor, you were somebody. Rich people invested in stocks. But wage earners didn't. I don't know of anybody, any blue-collar worker from the time I was, 10 years old until I was 40, that invested in stocks. But about 70s, but, you know, more likely about the 1980s, a metamorphosis came over America, and we started investing, you know, Joe Sixpacks. People were investing in stocks, started investing in stocks so that they could retire. And we were advised to do that by the paid professionals. You know, stocks just always go up. That's what I was told. Stocks always go up over the long haul. We're investing for the long haul. And we're going to make money in these stocks. And if you invest in these stocks, you know, and just keep doing that year after year after year for 40 years, you'll have enough money you can retire on and drive your Winnebago around America and just have a great time. So, you know, being kind of a born skeptic, you know, I looked at that and I said, you know, who's selling this? See, I'm a businessman and I know that people are motivated by five motivators. Write this down. It's vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. Five motivators. Vance Packard wrote a book back in 1958. It's called The Hidden Persuaders. The Hidden Persuaders. And it's vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. And all of us are motivated by these five motivators, these emotions that we have. Vanity. I've just got to be the top dog. I've got to let everybody know how great I am. You ever see people that are vain? Here's an example of it. Remember this Tammy Faye Baker? I mean, that woman was as ugly as a mud fence. A two-bagger if I ever saw one. But she made herself ugly. She wasn't naturally that ugly. She had to work at it. So she put on all this makeup. I mean, that woman, That woman had as much makeup on as anybody I've ever seen. I think that, you know, she could have gone out there and played a clown, you know, in the Barnum and Bailey circus, for crying out loud. I don't think that any woman could be that ugly, naturally. Now, I don't know if she was selling, cosmetics or something like that, you know. Maybe she was a cosmetic sales lady, I don't know. But she was out there, you know, parading around, selling religion, getting on the air, and one thing and another. Tammy Faye Baker, you know, just ugly as a mud fence. And she was a professional religionist, and she had a husband by the name of, Baker. Jim Baker. In fact, he's over in Branson, Missouri right now, selling religion again. It's the only thing he knows how to sell. He doesn't produce anything. He consumes much in the process. And you and I are the guys that are paying all this. We're the guys that send our money into these televangelists. You know how they make $100 million a year. This Jim Baker was making $100 million. Oral Roberts was making $100 million. Another guy over here, this Pat Robertson, he's still on the air. He makes $100 million a year. These aren't small businesses. And what is it that they're giving us in return? Well, in Leviticus 11, God tells us, here's what he thinks of preachers and lawyers in Leviticus 11. We go to the doctors, they give us vaccinations, they give us Alzheimer's, ADHD, crib death, and autism. 90% of the pediatricians do not vaccinate their own children. The government gives us paper money. In the Bible, God tells us that we ought not to use paper money and has two prohibitions against it in Leviticus 19, 35 and 36 and in Deuteronomy 25, 13 through 16. Our founding fathers in our Constitution abolished paper money in Article 1, Section 10 with the words that say, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. Now, I said we're going to take a look at stocks here, and I just want to point out to you that in 1960, if you had bought stocks, let's suppose you had $10,000 and then you invested in the stock market, blue chip stocks, nothing risky, just IBM and Standard Oil and Exxon, all the blue chip stocks. $10,000 in the stock market, and you just kept your stocks going, making up your tax returns and paying your taxes and doing all the good things that good folks do until 2000. That's 40 years. That's your whole working lifetime. Your $10,000 would have increased at the rate of 5% per annum, compounded annually for 40 years. That's a bunch of money. You know, you would cash out in 2000 with $73,000 and some change. $73,000. So they tell us, well, see, look what this guy did. He took $10,000 back in 1960, invested it in the stock market, invested for the long haul. And yes, it went up, and yes, it went down, but over the long haul, he made $73,000. Look where he's at today. All right. It sounds good. And all of this advice sounds good. Every con man that comes along sounds good. If it didn't sound good, we wouldn't buy it. In fact, it probably sounds better than the original. Now, here's the problem. Nobody counts. Nobody does the arithmetic, because over that same 40 years, that's not tax-free. You have to pay taxes on that $73,000. And so when you cash out, you pay what's called a capital gain tax, and at that time it was 28%. Furthermore, there was an inflation tax that was going on. That is, the purchasing power of money between 1960 and 2000 went down. To give you an illustration, if you had $100 in 1980, 20 years later, in 2000, your $100 would only buy $50 worth of goods. So you lost 50% of your purchasing power in that 20-year period. In a 7-year period, from the year 2000 to 2007, if you had $100 That $100 in 2007 would buy $67 worth of goods. You lost 33% of it in 7 years. That's 133% in 27 years. See? Now, the purchasing power of a dollar in 1960 was greater than the purchasing power of a dollar in 2000. And the compounded rate that you pay in inflation tax from 1960 to 2000 is 4.7%. So your net gain, your real net gain on the transaction is 0.3% a year compounded for 40 years. And when you get through paying your taxes and you get through paying the inflation tax, the $10,000 that you started with in 1960 cashed out for $73,000 in 2008. When you take it down to the store to buy, you can buy $3,800 less than you could have bought in 1960. You not only didn't make any money, you spent a lot of time, effort, and energy filling out tax returns. You took a lot of time, effort, and energy managing your investment portfolio. And when you got through and you took your $73,000 down to the store to buy goods, you'd actually get about one-third less goods than you could have bought back in 1960. Are stocks good? They're wonderful for stockbrokers and people that are selling stocks and raising cash and capital for their businesses. The stock market has a very valuable place in the economy. I don't deny that. It's just that when you invest in the stock market for the long haul, you lose about one-third of what you invested in it. You don't lose it all. You just lose about a third. So if you've got $10,000 and you think that's too much money and you'd like to invest that $10,000 over the next 40 years and you would like to lose about one-third of your purchasing power in the process, I can't think of a better place to put it than the stock market. It's a proven winner. If it does that from 1960 to 2000, why won't it do it from the year 2010 until the year 2050? I can't think of a better place to put your money. Personally, I don't want to lose a third of my purchasing power, so I'm not invested in stocks, nor do I intend to. I don't know of anybody that's ever made a dollar in the stock market. Well, I shouldn't say I don't know of anybody. There are some people that have gotten in and gotten out at the right time. There are people that do make money in the stock market, and I don't deny that. They buy a stock today and they sell it, you know, next week or next month. They got insider traders, you know, in the Goldman Sachs. I think that their trading ratio, their profit ratio on their trades is something in the, you know, 80% or 90% range. And they're just making money hand over fist. But everybody that makes money in the stock market makes it off of somebody that lost money in the stock market. The stock market produces no real new wealth. There's no wealth being produced in the stock market. It's a place where wealth is transferred from one guy to another. No doubt about that. But it doesn't create anything. Now, on the other hand, if we were creators, and that's where the Joe Sixpacks and the Sally Housewives, this is where the blue-collar worker comes in. See, as a carpenter, plumber, electrician, we're the guys that go out and actually take raw materials, put them together through our labor, and build a house for somebody, which gives him shelter from the elements. We actually produce things. Farmers go out and they take raw dirt and they put seeds in it and they work it and they harvest and they sell. They actually produce meat, milk, butter, and eggs. That's what you and I need to eat to live. So farmers are producers, truck drivers are producers, carpenters, plumbers, and electricians are producers. But bankers, economists, lawyers, doctors, brokers, and presidents, congressmen, politicians are non-producers, and they all consume meat, milk, butter, and eggs. And these are the people that are telling us to buy stocks. They want us to take what we produce, and we want to increase, And so we listen to these paid professionals, and we take our meat, milk, butter, and eggs and convert it to stocks, and then we lose it, or a portion thereof, which is then transferred to the economists, the bankers, the lawyers, the doctors, and the brokers. And we've been doing that for a long time, and we love it. And we think that that's the way to get ahead. And I just thought that I'd blow the whistle. And here's a guy that blew the whistle also, and I thought I'd read a little bit of it to you. Listen to this guy. He said, "For most of my professional life, I have been involved in the study of an emotionally charged subject. It's people's relations with alcoholic beverages. Now, as a public servant and as a private citizen, I have seen what emotional investment in the subject can do to anyone's objectivity. I have seen alcohol researchers literally shout down each other with conflicting interpretations of the same data. I have seen the preliminary results of small, uncontrolled research studies blazoned across the front pages of newspapers and sold as incontrovertible fact. I have seen impressive-looking but essentially meaningless statistical charts and graphs accompanying major articles in prestigious scientific journals that mean nothing. When it comes to subjugating objectivity to the service of emotion, I've seen a lot of it done. From time to time, I've even done it myself. But I didn't recognize the seduction when it was done to me." Now, listen to this guy. He says, "I'm out here seducing you as a paid professional with my expertise." That's patently false. "But I didn't recognize when somebody was doing it to me, when they were selling me." And so here's a guy who's a doctor, and he says, I'm subject to being bamboozled just like everybody else." That's a pretty good admission from one of the bamboozlers. A pretty good admission. "Yep, I've been bamboozled by these other hucksters, the economists, the bankers, the lawyers, and the brokers." Now, if I, a physician, a psychiatrist, once the head of a powerful government agency with long-time ties to the academic and the government worlds of science and statistics, can be misled, what about all the people who have not had such rigorous training? How do they make sense out of this cacophony of voices giving conflicting advice about every subject imaginable, from health and nutrition to child rearing, alcohol, drugs, safe food, pollution? Just who has the answers? Now, I believe this question is the most important and one of the most important questions for our day. Many people believe someone does, in fact, have all of the answers that they do not possess, because they want to believe in that magical someone. They want to believe. They're defenseless against those who claim to have this special knowledge, however. They're fair game for anyone who offers them comforting certainties, unambiguous rules of conduct, and ways to identify themselves within this complex society, this fast-moving, complex society that we live in, awash in prescriptions and proscriptions, but lacking a means of judging the validity of what they hear. They soon find themselves ruled by a tyranny of experts. That's why he entitled this article, "The Tyranny of Experts." Now, this tyranny of experts manifests itself in a way such as in health with vaccinations. Some guy goes to college and he gets through and he comes out and he writes a book and he says, "Hey, this vaccination is a great thing. It saves people from disease, and so we need more vaccination." He creates a foundation or some kind of a clinic or something, you know, that goes out and sells this idea. And then he goes to Congress and he testifies before Congress. And down in Texas, they came up with a program they've got cancer down there. They've got cervical cancer in women. And so to avoid cervical cancer in women, they came up with a vaccine. And then the legislature enacted a law that requires every girl in Texas to be vaccinated with this vaccine. This is the tyranny of experts. Now, it may be true that this vaccine is the greatest thing since sliced white bread, and it's going to eliminate cervical cancer in women. It hasn't. It doesn't. It won't. It can't. Never has. Isn't now. And never will. But, you know, assuming that it could, it'd probably be a good thing. But, you know, when we go back to 1900, when we were all dumb and didn't know what the hell was going on, we had one person who would contract cancer out of 33. Today it's 1 out of 2. Now, we're just working our hearts out over here, listening to all these experts telling us about cancer and what we need to do. My grandmother smoked Camel cigarettes from the time she was 18 years old until she was 85. She died, but she didn't die from lung cancer. Now, people that smoke, all of you people out there that are smoking, you know that smoking causes lung cancer, don't you? Well, you believe it. It doesn't. There isn't a lick of proof that smoking causes lung cancer. There's an association. They come to this conclusion. Since people who smoke come down with lung cancer more often than people who do not smoke, therefore, smoking causes lung cancer. But 85% of people who smoke don't die from lung cancer. They don't get lung cancer. 15% do. And 15% of people in that group is a higher percentage than 15% of people, let's say, in the Miller High Life group. So if you take two groups of people that are smoking cigarettes and people that are drinking Miller beer, and 15% of the smokers develop cancer, but only 5% of the Miller High Life people develop cancer, we come to a conclusion by association. But that's not proof. So somebody comes along and says, but I'm a doctor, and I've been studying this for years and years, and I'm here to tell you that smoking causes cancer, so therefore, he goes to Congress, and Congress says, well, by God, you know, that sounds pretty logical to us, and the pharmaceutical industry wants it, and on top of that, these groups are willing to give us campaign contributions if we vote for this bill, if we vote for this vaccine, if we vote for this or that, which is the real motivator for politicians. How much campaign contribution can I count on from you, you know, Pfizer and Merck? And that'll influence my vote in the upcoming controversy. So I'm pleased to report to you that there is another guy out here that's prepared to take the opposite side of the popular view concerning some pretty heavy issues. So stand by. Let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on to the archives page and you can download that free general law CD package right there. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors and publications that we're endorsing will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Or call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the paid professionals, the tyranny of the experts. Now, the tyranny of experts over here are the powers that are possessed by the people that are the movers and shakers in society. It's the 5% of the extroverts. 5%. 95% of us are introverts and 5% of us are extroverts. Bill Clinton is an extrovert. Barack Obama is an extrovert. You'll find that most people in public life are the movers and shakers. They're the guys that stand up and they talk a lot. They're not bashful people. They're not inhibited. And they've got opinions and ideas, and they're out espousing those opinions and ideas. And then the 95% of us, you know, the guys that stand in the back and keep our mouths shut and we just listen, we're influenced by these movers and shakers. And they come to us and they say, this is where the wave of the future is. This is what you need to do. Now, they don't persuade all of us every single time, but they persuade large numbers of us. And after all, that's where the money's at. If they can persuade, you know, a million people to buy a particular drug at $40, you know, a pill or something like that, you know, it isn't uncommon for people to buy pills, you know, that cost $20, $30, $40. That makes a lot of money for the pharmaceutical industry. The fact that later on we find out that this particular drug killed 40 or 50,000 people over a period of 10 or 15 years, they come to us and they say, well, you know, that's the trade-off that you pay. 50,000 people died, but 3 million people lived, and so there's a trade-off, you know. Well, what evidence do you have that this drug saved 3 million people? None. Let's think about this one for a minute. They come to us and they tell us to get our flu vaccine. And so we go out and we get our flu vaccine. Were you aware that if you've had 2 flu shots over the past 10 years, it raises your chances of getting Alzheimer's disease by 50%? You may not die from the flu. You may die from Alzheimer's instead. Now, they don't come to you and say, well, flu shots cause Alzheimer's disease. They come to you and say, smoking cigarettes causes Alzheimer's disease, using this same correlation. I can't say to you that flu shots cause Alzheimer's disease, but we do know this, that if over the last 10 years you've had a flu shot every year, or just two flu shots out of the last 10 years, your chances of getting Alzheimer's. Now, millions of people get flu shots and never get Alzheimer's disease. Millions of people smoke cigarettes and never die from lung cancer. But if we can draw the same conclusion with smoking and lung cancer, why can't we draw the same conclusion from vaccines and Alzheimer's? It's just a matter of, well, what are we selling? So we're selling away from cigarettes, but we're selling into vaccines. And that's what the bottom line is. These people have something to sell. And you and I are the customers. And that's why this professional is saying, hey, wait a minute, when I was selling it, that was one thing, but then when I got tricked into buying it, that's another. Now, he goes on to say here, he says, the people that I call tyrants are people who overstep the limits of their technical expertise, and they use their specialized knowledge to dictate how others should live. In our world of instant communication, we know of these experts and we know who they are. Many are scientists, public interest advocates, researchers, lawyers, physicians, psychologists, social workers, government bureaucrats, and others, who through our mass media, they parlay their credentials into power bases. And from these power bases, they tell us what to eat, what to drink, and what to enjoy. And they tell us how to relate to one another. And they tell us, in short, how we ought to live. These pronouncements from these experts, they fill the moral and the ethical vacuum left by the demise of the extended family and the waning of religious and political leadership. In many areas where basic values and personal views of the world once helped people make choices, they now turn to the experts for what they believe is definitive information. In a world reeling from the dizzying pace of growth and change, being told what to eat, how much sleep to get, and how to rear children, gives people a semblance of certainty that is difficult to come by anywhere else. And because the experts fill a genuine need for order in this chaotic world of high-tech, high-speed living, some of us remain stunningly blind to their pervasive, massive encroachment on the prerogatives of our private lives, as well as to the possibility that something besides pure benevolence motivates their actions. Our innate self-protectiveness is disarmed but not broken. That characteristic American prickliness, for example, comes to the fore when we learn that the video store's computer keeps a record of every video that we rent. The bottom line to all of this is money. What we're really dealing with here is sales. So when somebody says to you that you need a flu vaccine, if you were to look into vaccines, you would find that vaccines don't prevent disease. It's your immune system that prevents disease. So somebody comes along, he's a paid professional, he's an expert. And then he says, well, see, the vaccine, it helps your immune system ward off the disease. That's a patent lie. Vaccines do not help your immune system at all. Vaccines suppress your immune system. Every vaccine does, without exception. So, you and I don't know because we're plumbers, carpenters, and electricians, and so we rely upon the doctor. The doctor comes to us and says, this vaccine is good for you. It's going to keep you from getting the flu. So you take the vaccine. 35% of the people who take the flu vaccine get the flu. 35%. That's a third. One out of every three people, after they take their flu shot, get the flu. So that tells us a couple of things here. Number one, there's no guarantee that after you take your flu vaccine that you're going to be protected from the flu. Now, the conclusion that most people would come to, well, it protected two-thirds of them. No, it didn't. You don't have any evidence of that. Not at all. You can take somebody that's got the flu, walk into a room with 100 people. He's coughing and sneezing and whacking and wheezing. And every time he sneezes, he's blowing germs 20 feet out in front of him. In 15 or 20 minutes, he'll infect every single person in the room. But not all 100 people are going to come down with the flu. Only 10 or 15% will. If you vaccinate those 100 people in the room, 35% of them will come down with the flu. So the vaccine doesn't do anything for that 35%. And the other 65%, they didn't need the vaccine at all. They weren't going to get the flu anyway. Their immune system warded it off. Then these very same people that get the flu will say, can you imagine how sick I would have been if I didn't get my flu shot? Wait a minute. The flu shot doesn't ameliorate the effectiveness of the flu one way or the other. It either protects you from it or it doesn't. And the answer is it doesn't, never has, and never will. That's what the bottom line is. Why are we selling flu vaccine? To make money. It costs $25 a shot. Every time we sell a shot, we make $25. And typically it doesn't kill anybody or harm anybody, but the people believe that it keeps them from getting the flu, which it doesn't. The 65% weren't going to get the flu anyway. And the 35% were going to get the flu whether they had the shot or not. Does that mean that when you get the flu shot, it gives the flu to 35%? Probably, but we don't know that. There isn't any real way to test it. And this guy points that out. He's a medical doctor. He says all these tests that these guys are performing, they're meaningless. You know, it doesn't prove anything one way or the other. And it's because it isn't possible to prove it one way or the other. We come to you and we say, well, we get a double-blind test, and we prove that this is true. You and I believe it because they told us that they did a double-blind test, and it proves that it's true. But you and I don't know how to do a double-blind test. We don't even know what the hell it is. But we believe what they tell us. And if something is in print, it becomes gospel. All you have to do is write it up and print it. Put it in the newspaper. Everybody will believe what they read in the newspaper, which is probably 90% false. It's at least 25% false, and that's because everything that comes out of your mouth is 25% false. And that's when you intend to tell the truth. We know that scientifically. We can test that. That doesn't mean that everybody lies 100% of the time, but they just lie, you know, a certain amount of the time. All right, now this guy's got a good line here. Let me give you a couple of more. The potential misuse of this information violates our privacy, and it conjures up images of Big Brother and the thought police. It brings up thoughts of George Orwell's novel, 1984. And to me, it's a far more chilling prospect. And what's even worse is the surrender of our right to choose in return for promises of happiness and harmony, as in the fictional society described by Aldous Huxley in his book called Brave New World. We're learning that the most powerful tyrant of all is one who possesses the consent of the tyrannized. In order to get our consent, they have to persuade us to go down and get the shot. An illustration of it here in our state. They have a law in the books, and it says you have to have your kid vaccinated to send him to public school. That's not true. There's exceptions to that rule. I sent my children to public school, and they didn't get any shots. You sent your children to public school, and they all got shot up. What's the difference? Well, the difference is the exception. See, they have a program here for religious objectors and people that have medical conditions to be exempted. We have a religious objection, and so we advanced the religious objection, and we were exempted. That's all. You could do it. I can do it. Everybody can do it. Most people, 88%, believe in vaccinations and they want them. Hell, I don't want to discourage people who want vaccinations from getting vaccinated. If you want it, I think that you should go get it. I just don't want you terrorizing me, I guess I could use that term, terror, by threatening me and going to put me in jail or take my children away from me if I don't conform with your philosophies, your beliefs. That's the tyranny of the majority. He said, I believe we're in danger of surrendering our intellectual and emotional liberty to those who would warn, advise, and guide us. People who manipulate us with their specialized knowledge. And increasingly, they determine the political, moral, and social climate of our country. I fear the brave new world. I fear their tactics threaten to bring upon all of us a tyranny. I want us to regain our right to think for ourselves by withdrawing our consent to their ascendancy. Well, you know, that's a matter of choice, and you and I can do that. I don't know whether you're in favor of vaccines or not. You know, that's your choice in life, and God love you. I hope you make your choice. I made my choice, and mine is I don't want the vaccines. And I know right away you're going to start sending me emails and saying, Mr. Gordon, you know, you're misinformed. You're really dumb. You just really haven't. Boys and girls, I have a file folder in here in my file cabinet that's about 2 inches thick with material on vaccination. I defy any of you who are going to write me an email and tell me that you've got 4 inches of material on vaccination. I am not ignorant concerning vaccines or vaccination. I don't claim to be an expert, but then I'm not here trying to persuade you that you should or should not get vaccine. I don't know whether you should or shouldn't. That's your choice in life to make. I just know that you shouldn't be making that choice for me. I should make that choice for me. And I did, and fortunately, we live in a country where we can make that choice. Although the experts would have you believe that there is no choice, it's the law. And oftentimes they'll tell you that. Social lady will tell you it's the law. And she may actually believe that. She may be like this professional. Remember, social lady is a professional too. And these professionals, they get bamboozled by the other professionals that are bamboozling all the rest of us. Bamboozle, that is conning us, persuading us that they know a whole lot more than they really do. Now, that's not to say that doctors aren't smart people, but when you come down with cancer, you're going to go to a doctor. You know, when you're feeling bad and you got pain, and he's going to give you a battery of tests that's going to cost you a lot of money. And it's going to enrich the doctor and the hospital, and they're going to make money off of you. And they're going to come back to you and say, hey, you've got cancer. And you're going to be just devastated. You're just going to freak out and, oh, my God, I've got cancer, and I just don't know why. I'm only 35. You got cancer because of the choices that you made in the first 35 years of your life. You know, the things that you ate, the brand of cigarettes that you smoked, and so on. There's a cause and effect relationship here. And so now when you come down with cancer, I want you to ask the doctor this question. Doc, do you know what causes cancer? And he's going to say, no, we don't know what causes cancer yet, but we're researching that and we're trying to find out. Doc, do you know how to cure cancer? And the doctor's going to say, no, we don't know how to cure cancer, but we have treatments, and we have high hopes, and we're looking for a cure. So here's the doctor. He says, now, we don't know what causes this cancer, and we don't know how to cure it. Now I ask the doc, well, what should I do? And the doctor will say, well, we have a treatment regimen. For $100,000, we can treat you. Doc, will that cure me? No, we're not offering you a cure. We're offering you a treatment for $100,000. Well, how long can I expect to live if I take your treatment? And the answer is, on average, 18 months. If you spend $100,000 and take the full range of treatment from the doctor, you can expect to extend your life 18 months. Now, here's what the doctor doesn't tell you. When you get this report from the doctor that says you've got cancer, if you do absolutely nothing, you just go home and live your life, do you know what your average lifespan will be? The answer is, on average, 6 years. So if you take the doctor's full range of treatment, your average lifespan for the $100,000 that you're going to spend is 18 months. If you do absolutely nothing, just go home, spend your $100,000 on beer and pretzels, and live your life, you're going to live for 6 years on average. They don't tell you that. That's right, the paid professionals don't tell you that. I'm telling you that because that's what's available on the internet. Go look it up. Go look it up. Average lifespan for cancer. It's out there. It's out there in black and white. Published by the American Medical Association, the FDA. And so the experts, they terrorize us. My God, if you don't have this treatment over here, you're going to die. Well, hell, you're going to die anyway. Son, you've got cancer. Wake up and smell the coffee. You're going to die. Now, another thing they don't tell you is that 37% of the time, they can keep you alive for 5 years. Now, if you live for 5 years, and you're one of that 37 people out of 100, all 100 of you now have been diagnosed with cancer, and they'll give you the full range of treatment, cut, burn, and poison, do everything they can. They'll take $100,000 from 100 people. 37 of them will live for 5 years. Of the 37 that live for 5 years, they call that a cure. Of the 63 that die, they said, well, we never said we had a cure to start with. But they collected $100,000 from the 63 that died, as well as the 37 that lived. Furthermore, of the 37 who live for 6, 7, or 8 years and then die, see, well, you were cured. If you die from cancer in the 8th year, they will say, well, it reoccurred, but it's a separate event. Isn't that special? All right. Now, that's what I call the tyranny of experts. And that's what this guy is calling the tyranny of experts. These experts come along, and they give us a line. They're selling something to us. They're selling us a $100,000 program. And God love them, doctors and hospitals and nurses and all the people that are involved in medicine. They need to make money. They need to pay their mortgage payments, and they need to buy food, clothing, and shelter, and pay their car payments, just like all the rest of us. Now, there's a better way to do things, and in fact, if you have cancer, there's 14 cures to cancer. 14. Nobody tells you that. Don't you think somebody ought to step up and say, now, wait a minute, instead of listening to the paid professionals, why don't we listen to the lay people over here that have had cancer or that have cured cancer, because there's 14 cures? Does anybody tell you that? Well, why would the doctor want to tell you about a cure to cancer that's sold by his competitor down the street? Why would a pharmaceutical company do that? It's not in their financial best interest. So even if they knew, they wouldn't tell you. And like as not, they don't know because they're not looking. Not looking. And that's called the tyranny of the paid professional. Hey, I'm out of time. I got to give you a final reminder here. We'll be back with more tomorrow. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.